This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is The Review, a podcast from the Atlantic's culture team about movies, television, and all the things we make as an alternative to putting a chip in our heads to dull the pain of existence. I am Spencer Kornhaber, a staff writer at the Atlantic, and I'm joined today by two other staff writers on our culture team, Sophie Gilbert.
Yep, you can call me Sophie G.
Sophie G, as yes, we're okay, we'll forgo last names here. Sophie G and David S.
Hello. Wait, what is there some positive greeting? They don't have a positive greeting that they give, right?
Like, what's for dinner, kids, or whatever?
Yeah. What's for dinner, kids? There you go.
All right. We are already well within a web of inside references to today's topic, the Apple TV Plus show Severance, a dystopian-y, sci-fi-y, psychological thriller that has become the maybe most acclaimed show of the year. What do you think, Sophie, as our TV critic? Is it the TV show of the year?
Yes, I would say it is the one that has gathered the most hype over the course of its run. It was certainly the one that I've seen people talking about more than anything else, which, you know, in part could be, I think, because of just the strangeness of the show. But it also, I think, has gathered a lot of fans for justifiable reasons.
Yeah. The finale was last month. But it feels like people are still catching up on the show and still becoming obsessed and talking about it. So we're going to try to sort through why it's become this obsession and what it says about workplace culture today. So if you do want to like explain what the heck is going on with the show, like what is it?
I wish I could. Yes, I will try. It is a show largely written by Dan Erickson, who is a first-time screenwriter, directed by Ben Stiller, the comedian, writer, director. It is a show that begins in its first scene with a woman passed out on a conference table in this very like meticulously staged, gorgeous shot. The carpet and her dress and everything is this like very clashing sense of green, and she, I think, is representing us, the viewers. We have no idea what's going on, and it turns out that she has undergone, her name is Heliar, she has undergone a process called severance.
I have, of my own free accord, elected to undergo the procedure colloquially known as severance. I give consent for my perceptual chronologies to be surgically split, separating my memories between my work life and my personal life.
Our protagonist is Mark, played by Adam Scott, who works for a very mysterious company called Lumen Industries, which has implanted a chip in his brain, with his permission, that divides his memory and perception in two. Every time he steps into the elevator down to the quote-unquote severed floor of Lumen, it triggers the chip, and he is, I think, geospatially separated into his work self, who knows nothing about his home self. Work Mark has no idea what his life is like outside the office. Outside Mark doesn't know what Work Mark does. And honestly, like, Work Mark doesn't seem to know what Work Mark does either. This is a very, whatever is happening at Lumen, there are bottle-fed goats There are lots and lots and lots and lots of corridors. There is a cult of personality run around the company's founders, the Egan family. There's a lot going on. And so while it may seem that Mark has achieved the goal of work-life balance, what he's actually done, as we see in the show, is essentially enslaved a portion of himself who never gets to leave the office.
I acknowledge that henceforth my access to my memories will be spatially dictated. I will be unable to access outside recollections whilst on Lumen's severed basement floor, nor retain work memories upon my ascent.
It's kind of the opposite of what I wrote in my review. It's kind of the opposite of what we've all gone through during, well, what lots of us have gone through during the pandemic, which is like kind of bleeding into the home life where everything, every room is suddenly, you're working in bed, you're working on the couch, you're working in the spare room, you're working in the bathroom, you're working everywhere. It's kind of the opposite of that. Like you only work inside Lumen Industries' severed floor.
Yeah, but it's like whenever you turned on Zoom, you suddenly forgot.
Right.
What was happening in the kitchen or something.
Right. One thing I think that the show has really sets it apart as a kind of puzzle box, slightly strange mystery show is its tone. It really strikes this sort of excellent balance between weird, compelling drama and very absurd comedy. The visuals of it are so sinister, like the austerity of Lumen, the 70s vibe, the retro tech, the absolutely terrifying non-severed office employees and the bosses. I think there's Mrs. Cobell, played by Patricia Arquette, and Mr. Milchick, the supervisor on the severed floor, who's played by Tramell Tillman, in a performance that similarly is just perfectly pitched between comic and horrifying.
Hello, refiners.
Hi, Mr. Milchick.
Helly, I'm agog at how well I can tell you're already fitting in.
Well, David, do you like Severance?
Yes, I love the show deeply. And I can be a bit of a grump about television these days. I think Netflix ruined television forever and it's all really bad now. And sometimes I annoy people at bars with this opinion. And then once in a while, a show will come along that reminds me of the halcyon days of the early 2000s when, you know, whatever, TV was good in my, you know, stupid opinion. And this show just reminds me of just the joyful discovery of like some, you know, sci-fi serial like Lost, where we were all in it together. We were all like, look, I don't know if this thing's gonna figure everything out at the end. Like, I don't know if all these mysteries are gonna make sense. Like, but just the act of seeing all this creativity on screen and then chatting about it with each other and thinking about like, oh, what could it mean? And plus, as Sophie's saying, all the clever aesthetics of it and the way it's sort of commenting on office life and the office comedy and like, you know, sort of TV formulas that we know, it's just all so exciting. It's like the TV show that's excited me the most in recent memory. I can't think of another, like that feeling where you're like, ooh, we get to watch a Severance, you know, like you know, like that really rare. I don't know, Sophie, if you agree, but it's like rare these days that you're like, oh, it's whatever day it is. It's Tuesday. Time for a Severance. Like, we get to see another one. Like, I just never have that feeling anymore.
Yeah, I think the shows that I look forward to most like that are usually sort of fairly light and escapist.
Right, like The Gilded Age, for example. I'd be like, ah, The Gilded Age! Yes! I get to put my head in a blender, like, stupidest show on TV.
Yes. Going to snub this week. No, I agree. This is like very, very, very different. But it does keep you paying attention in all kinds of really provocative ways.
Right. Like, what was that just there? Wait a second. You know, a lot of that kind of,
Well, it's interesting because it reminds you of so many things. Like, it, obviously, watching it, you know, it has like Charlie Kaufman style pieces of it. And it, you know, it reminded me a lot of Black Mirror. And there have been a lot of shows recently that are thinking about like free will and consciousness. There was Devs on FX and Hulu, Alex Garland's very bleak show about data programmers.
Sure, about big tech gone awry or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever Devs was about.
There's Westworld and the idea that actually, although the robots were not in charge of their own destiny, I think in the last season was sort of playing with the idea that human beings aren't either. The Black Mirror pieces of it really fascinate me. And then it turned out that Dan Erickson was actually thinking about White Christmas in part when he was thinking about the show, and just the idea that our consciousness can be imprisoned by ourselves. So I don't know, the mood board of things that the creators were inspired by when they were making the show. I think there's like a 5 minute long Sizzler commercial that we've all now watched because it's
it was
like,
pretty good.
1991.
It's like a Scientology presentation.
Sizzler brings the choices that you've been looking for, giving you the right to choose. We're offering much more.
It's so good.
We are revolutionizing the idea of dinner. You can eat at the buffet or you can sit at a table, and that is choice, and choice is America, my friend. It's a really great piece.
Yeah.
Very strange 1990s.
Corporate propaganda.
Corporate propaganda, exactly.
Yeah, it's like the text for too many cooks and all the adults and post-ironic entertainments.
Hey, we've been so worried about free will all this time, and Sizzler was right there. Spencer, did you like the show?
I think you are both chipped. I think this show is not that great. Wow. Sorry.
Are you serious? You're crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I hear everything you're saying. Love the melange of influences. Think it's working with such wonderful, weighty media ideas. But the pacing is excruciating. Ben Stiller has never met a hallway or car that he does not want to depict every moment of someone moving through it or exiting that car. I think it's like such a wonderful concept, Severance. And I wish that it kind of explored that idea a little more straightforwardly instead of making it just a pretext for another show about an evil corporation with a shadowy conspiracy that's trying to re-engineer the human experience. But I'm glad that you both like it.
That's okay. I hear you. I acknowledge the you that you are. I do think that the show, at very much in the first few episodes, is kind of sluggish in pacing. Mm-hmm. And I definitely agree with you about how the shots of the corridor walking, they start to feel, especially because there's not much dialogue happening. I think it's just like Adam Scott walking down the hallway for like 2 minutes. But there's a lot of acting happening in that time. And I think the thing that set it apart for me from other shows with shadowy, nefarious corporations was its sense of humor, which is just so absurd and wacky. And there's just the quest, like, there's so much going on. Like, Egan is such a strange place. What is up with the goats? What is up with the, I mean, well, I don't want to spoil this too much, but there is a work gathering where one of the options on the playlist is Defiant Jazz. There's a melon party. Everything is just done with such pitch perfect seriousness, and yet it is on its face completely absurd. It has made me completely rethink like every kind of professional work event that I have ever been to.
If we hit our numbers by quarter's end, one of us gets named Refiner of the Quarter, and that shit gets you a waffle party.
I'm sorry, a waffle party?
I mean, it's making humor out of, yeah, like internal propaganda and sort of like the false bonhomie that you kind of have to have at work. Like, you know, the feeling of when your boss tells you we're all a family when really they're exploiting you.
Right.
But that's the territory of like, you know, Office Space, The Office, many, 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 many workplace comedies. And a lot of that felt sort of rehashed to me, no?
What you're describing was my fear. Like the opening episode where he's walking through the hallways and my wife was like, is this going to be one of those shows that every episode's a fucking hour and nothing happens? And you know, which is basically like to me, all prestige TV now, right? Like all prestige to me, TV to me, like by episode 9, they're like, and now the premise is established. And you're like, yes. You know, what the hell? Why is this taking so long? You know? Yeah. And then the finale, they're like, we'll see you next year. Netflix is like, you're canceled. But anyway. what I thought this show was going to much more slowly peel back the nightmare, because, you know, have the early episodes be like, yes, there's this strange thing where we're not, you know, connected to our outside selves, but we're doing our work and it's an office comedy. And then almost immediately it's like, no, if this existed, these people would live in a nightmare from which there is no escape. And so how would people deal with that becomes the immediate plot line in several, like, I feel like by like episode 2 or 3, like, you know, John Turturro's character is the happy camper who's, you know, trying to absorb all of the weird corporate propaganda, right? Hallie is the, you know, the rebel who is doing everything she can to basically like wage war on her own body to try and shock herself out of the job. And, you know, Zach Cherry is like such a good version of the comic character from like an Office Space, like the goof off, right? Except like it's like he's trying to like, you know, solve a video game to which like he can't win. There's something just sort of like dire and incredibly funny but incredibly bleak about that.
The erasers are mostly decorative since we don't have pencils. Finger trap is fun as long as you know how to use it safely, but it's really more about what they represent, how far you got in the file.
So yes, Mark works with three other severed co-workers. Dylan G, played by the fan favorite Zach Cherry. There is right. Irving B, played by John Turturro. Just a really striking performance.
We should hide inspirational handbook quotes around the office for her to stumble upon.
She just needs to start earning perks, dude. I'd end my life if I didn't have any finger traps yet.
I was just sort of immediately like thrilled that the show was about how insane a sci-fi premise this is versus being like a light satire of office culture. It is like a nightmarish satire of office culture. Like it just escalated far faster than I thought it would.
I mean, I hear that. And I think that you isolating the actual four principles is like the best argument for the show and the way they kind of like fit into these different archetypes of people you've seen in workplace shows before. Maybe we should talk about them. Like Helly is waging war on her own body.
Am I trapped here?
In what way?
Like, if it turns out I hate this and I want to quit, is that an option?
If you're really unhappy, you can submit a resignation request with your outside self for review.
And good luck getting that approved.
Yeah, they do tend to be rejected.
She comes in as the newbie and has the most rational, sympathetic reaction, which is, what the hell? This is right, awful. This is get insane. Me out of here.
Why would I do Please. This? And the rest of them are like, you don't understand. Yeah, sure, the job makes no sense and you don't know what you're doing and you're just looking at a computer and having weird emotions that you get, you know, help guide you through the day. But, you know, you'll get used to it. And she's like, I'm not going to get used to this. Are you out of your mind? Let me out at once. And if not, I'm going to kill myself. Like, well, and like, I feel like there's a version of the show where that happens in episode 10. And, you know, and I was happy that was not the case.
Well, the contrast between Helly and Mark is pretty perfect, right? Because we don't see anything of Helly's severed. Her outie's life. We haven't even mentioned that the inside selves are called innies and that outsides are called outies. Belly button
yuck.
Television. But
it's a good yuck. I understand that.
But yeah, we don't see any of Helly's outie life until the finale. But we see all of Mark's. We see his kind of despair after his wife's death and his grief and how his outie self is profoundly miserable. And then in the thing that I find so intriguing in the first episode is you see him in the elevator and you hear the like bloop, the kind of fluttery sound and the elevator ping, and you see his eyes go bloop, bloop, and he is suddenly Innie Mark and he's free. You know, he's like inside the office. He is free from this like awful burden of sadness and drinking wine in front of the TV until, you know, 7 a.m. It's just like a... They work so well as characters together, I think, because they really are coming from opposite perspectives. Like for one, this is an absolute torture, and for the other, it's an escape. And then you kind of know that they're going to change each other by the finale and motivate each other.
What do you think of the portrayal of the outie world? Yeah.
I feel like you detect a lot of creep from Lumon in the outer world that is sort of, you know, unspoken, like these weird sort of prefab villages that they all live in and the houses all kind of looking the same and all that, right?
Yeah, the outie world feels recognizably like our own. The only like slightly strange element of it is the amazing work of self-help genius that Mark's brother-in-law his brother-in-law Rickon is writing this amazing work of self-help called The Wee We Are, which, you know, is this patently absurd, completely nonsensical tone, but then for some reason, somehow, it gets into the Lumen severed floor and is discovered by the workers who, not having any concept of anything other than their office, hail it as a work of great genius and liberation.
Yeah, I love that. It becomes like the Communist Manifesto to them, this D-list self-help book.
What separates man from machine is that machines cannot think for themselves. Also, they are made of metal. whereas man is made of skin.
If you are a soldier.
I think that is the funniest part. The book itself is just the most drivel of self-help that right. you could ever imagine. Well,
bullies are bull and lies or whatever. Is that it?
Something, yeah. False etymologies for words all the time.
A good person will follow the rules. A great person will follow himself. Bullies are nothing but bull and lies. At the center of industry is dust.
What I love about Ricken's book is that it is both the dumbest thing that you've ever read, but it also is like honestly radical and life-changing and helpful to these people that are trapped in Lumen, who are essentially one-year-old children and have never been exposed to any sort of philosophy about the world other than their corporate propaganda. And I guess it makes me a little more sympathetic to the self-help consumers of the world who I have never made fun of, but I imagine that other people have.
No, I love it so much. I love that there's like these clean slate babies and innies just don't know anything apart from the Severance world. Like they don't, what do they talk about at the water cooler? Nothing. They don't know TV. They don't watch anything. They don't read books apart from the we are. It's such a wonderful, weird setup. The thing I liked about the weirdness of Severance, there are a lot of shows that you watch where you know that you're just never going to get answers. Like Twin Peaks, you're never going to really understand what's going on there. At The Leftovers, you know that you're never really going to find out why 3% of the world's population suddenly disappeared and never came back. I mean, there are theories and there are, you know, like hints of things that may or may not have happened, but basically it's, you have to let the mystery be. And with Severance, I really do feel like there are answers and you get enough of them throughout the course of season one that you can kind of have faith that one day you will find out what Egan is, what it's doing.
But isn't this a trap that we've fallen into before?
No, like, I have faith.
Like these shows never pay off well. And it, you know, it gives me a lot of Westworld where this technology, it seems like it's a limited application at first and it's a cute little innovation. But then there's like these overlords who are thinking about how they're going to change everyone on Earth with this technology and you know, really re-engineer what it means to be a human. And also there's an apocalyptic backdrop. And also there's counter movements and rebellions within it. And it's just going to spiral out. And I mean, I hope that they pull it off, but it's just, we've seen so many times before the way that this is just not a sustainable mode of storytelling. And something like The Lost or Left, like something like Lost or The Leftovers, you know, does frustrate people, but I think is a much more kind of powerful form of playing with these kind of surreal seeming dystopian ideas, where it's like, no, you are not going to get every answer. But you have to like, so you have to enjoy the characters and you have to enjoy the theme and you have to enjoy the setting. And you can't just be hitting next episode and hoping to like have all your questions answered, because that will ultimately be unfulfilling.
But so that's you're describing the experience of watching Lost, though, for a lot of people. As much as I would totally defend Lost, people absolutely were hitting next episode hoping to get their questions answered. I mean, the thing with so many of those, especially the Lindelof shows, which you're, you know, Lost and The Leftovers both are, is like, you know, there's sort of like, there's an element of kind of spiritualism and kind of a like, look, at the end of the day, we don't know, to his storytelling. Like, at the end of the day, there are things that we don't understand about, like, you know, life and creation or, what you know, like God, or, you know, that he bakes into his storytelling. And I think that would always end up frustrating people. Not me. I would end up happy as a clam. But some people would be like, well, David, wait a second. It can't just be like there was magic, you know, and it's like, well, you know, kind of. But I'll take Dan Erickson at his word when he says, like, I've got an ending for this thing. Like, you know, I don't think this is the kind of... The problem with Lost was it's like we landed on an island and there's everything on it. So it became this very difficult task of like, well, how on earth do you tie the polar bear to the Egyptian statue? Like, I don't, you know, like, it's like, you've just thrown everything into the blender. How could you possibly create a grand unified theory here? And whereas Severance, it's like, there's a company, they're up to no good. Now we know a little of what they're up to and we'll learn more. But like, it does feel a little more focused to me than Lost. I mean, the thing with Westworld, which you're bringing up, like, Westworld was an adaptation of a movie that had an ending. And then the end of Westworld season one, we had now done the movie and they were like, all right, more. And it's like, I don't, you know, this thing was not built to have more. Like, this thing was built to be, what if you were at a robot Westworld and like the robots ran amok? That would be bad. But like then season two of Westworld is like, but what actually drives consciousness? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, what, this is season two? Like, you know.
But Severance is going to have to like answer a question like that, right? Like that you, and it seems to be dancing around a lot of the sort of existential, you know, mysteries that it raises about like, who are you really? Like, if you have all your memories removed, like, what's your personality? And I don't know, what do we really want out of work and all that? And so far, just kind of like leading us along. I don't know, Sophie, you kind of pointed this in your review, like it's batting at these ideas, but does it have a point of view?
I don't think it needs to necessarily. I think it's like, it's enough for us to think about these things.
So I'll never leave here.
You'll leave at 5, but it won't feel like it. Not to this version of you anyway.
And I have no choice.
Well, every time you find yourself here, it's because you chose to come back.
I think it's really fascinating that this show, which says so many things about late capitalism and our experience of work as mandated by large corporations with boards that tend not to see humans necessarily as individuals with souls and complex personal lives and feelings and interiority, but less as, you know, kind of a vast amorphous pool of workers to be drawn from as need be. Like, it's really fascinating to me that this show is airing on Apple. Like, there are things that seem...
This show is really making fun of Apple. Like, it's funny that they let it through.
There's a cult of personality in a huge corporation built around a mysterious founder.
Right.
I mean,
where everything's all white and retro. Yeah. Like, yeah.
It feels, I mean, there are things that feel directly drawn from real things that Amazon has done to its employees. Like, I think offering them, when they're very stressed or burned out, offering them like 10-minute wellness, like check-ins or guided meditations, you know, like the break room, which is so brilliant because of the double entendre of the word break. Like, yes, the break room, but also it is where we will psychologically break our employees until they apologize. Like, it's so subversive in such an intriguing way. And it's definitely, you don't expect to find something like this necessarily on Apple TV streaming platform.
Yeah. What's, how is Apple doing in the streaming race? Is this TV show like,
well,
it pulling ahead or something?
Well, I think, and maybe I myself am guilty of this. I don't know if other people did it quite as much. I can't remember. But when Apple launched, there was such a sense of like, who needs this? Like, we don't need another streaming platform. Like, they even make jokes about it in season two of The Morning Show, where I think the fictional network there is like launching a streaming platform. And everyone's like, no, we don't want another one. No one wants this. This is too much TV. What? And, you know, when Apple launched, it didn't have the back catalog that Netflix had or HBO had, or, you know, and there was no pre-existing like Apple IP. There was nothing there. So the shows that it launched with were the shows that you got when you signed up for Apple TV. And I think in that initial lineup of product, there was not a ton. Yeah, there was like
my dad watches C.
The Blind Jason Momoa.
It is four dads for sure.
I mean, we've talked about the insanity that is Steve Knight of Peaky Blinders and Spencer before on the podcast.
Right, that's right.
The man has never met a genre he won't touch. There was The Morning Show, which I think got a lot of flack for how much money it purportedly cost for its enormous stars. And I think at this point has just descended into high camp masterpiece. There was Dickinson, which was the lowest profile of them all, and I think turned out to be cult favorite.
Quite well liked, right? I feel like people are always telling me For All Mankind got really good. That's a show I keep meaning to get to.
I couldn't get past season one of that, honestly. I respect people who could. But, you know, for the first flush of shows that it came out with, they were not super compelling. But then came Ted Lasso, which I think now is everyone's and their dad's and their mom's and their sister-in-law's favorite comedy. And then slowly, like, the shows that have been coming out, there's Slow Horses, which is the Mick Herron spy adaptation with Gary Oldman. There's all these actually really, really well-crafted shows, and it does make the case for Apple as actually one of the most successful if you're into quality television, one of the most successful streaming networks out there right now, I don't know whether what that says for it in terms of its success financially, but David, maybe you know more about that than I do.
So when Apple TV Plus sort of started to get off the ground, they brought in Richard Plepler, who worked at HBO for 27 years, as sort of one of the big architects of what we think of as HBO's, you know, golden era, right? In the late 90s through to the 2010s, where they really emphasized a new HBO show being an event, right? Like, they didn't really flood the zone. HBO would usually just have a new episode of something on Sundays, but it was real water cooler stuff. Everyone, you know, should be discussing it the next day. The Sopranos, Game of Thrones, True Blood, Boardwalk Empire, The Newsroom, Veep, Big Little Lies, True Detective, you know, a zillion, like all this kind of stuff. And he moved on from HBO when it got sucked into the corporate structure of AT&T and they wanted, you know, to do lots more, right? HBO Max, we're going to try and imitate Netflix. And I feel like Apple TV is now trying to slide into that space of like an Apple show is an event. Like an Apple show is this very glossy, impressive, star-laden product that is going to come out weekly and is going to be much discussed. Now, has that worked yet? I think in bits and pieces, right, Sophie? Like the morning show, you know, was so star-laden that it definitely had some moments where people were kind of like, are you guys watching this? Like, you know, this thing's crazy.
Yeah, and then obviously I'm not Ted Lasso. The morning show.
No. I feel like also the second season people sort of fell off. But and then Ted Lasso and Mythic Quest were these sort of surprise, like small scale comedies that became like buzzier, you know, and things like that. Whereas then they also had things like Foundation, which have you all watched Foundation? Like,
no.
Must have cost $1 billion. You're watching and you're just like, this thing is crazy. It's, you know, trying to adapt one of the most complex and interesting and unadaptable sci-fi classics of all time, and you're sort of watching it like, I appreciate this effort, it's so glossy, I just don't, you know, it's obviously not really breaking through. Severance feels like one of the first ones where friends of mine are just sort of like, you watch that thing, like, you know, like it's sort of spreading through word of mouth.
But yeah, no, I mean, I think the quality versus quantity argument is a really interesting thing to consider, because I do think like HBO used to be very, very distinctive in what it greenlit and what it put on television. And now it feels much more like there's just a bunch of stuff on HBO Max and there's all kinds of things. And I think it kind of is depending on the idea that people will log into HBO Max like they do with Netflix and just browse
right.
for shows. Whereas Apple seems to be picking its content, shall we say, for want of a better word, more selectively. And, you know, it doesn't entirely always 100% pay off, but you are also getting shows like Severance and shows like Ted Lasso, which I think many people would agree worth paying money for. I have, and the thing is too, like, I'm not sure if it's a sustainable financial model for any company other than Apple, which has all the money in the entire world to throw at content. But because they do, we get to sit here and enjoy it, which is nice.
Yeah.
Well, David, you just wrote about, meanwhile, Netflix is starting to deflate, right?
Well, I mean, it's just the whole magic of Netflix has always been this company that spends wildly, you know, and borrows money wildly and sort of, you know, keeps expanding wildly with this promise that they've always made to their investors of like the numbers of subscribers are going to just keep going up. And since that has basically been true for 10 years, they kind of, the argument has made a certain sort of sense, and just one quarter of their numbers going down a little bit, but also them saying like, yeah, and we're probably going to lose a couple more million subscribers this year, has sort of burst the weird reality bubble around that company. And now I feel like everyone in the industry within Netflix and outside of it is sort of having this reckoning moment where it's like, oh, okay, so is that not the strategy anymore? Are we not all just going to try to flood the zone with television to try and keep up with everyone else? You know, like, I think that there's just a little bit of a like, okay, maybe the sky, it does have limits for just getting people to subscribe to Netflix over and over and over and over again around the world. I don't know. There's all, I mean, it's a podcast unto itself what's happening with Netflix right now. Yeah. But yeah. And so, right. Maybe a more curated approach is best, but like Sophie says, it does help that Apple is worth a quadrillion dollars or whatever, right? Like, you know, so they don't, money is a different concept to them even than to something like Netflix, which is, you know, Netflix doesn't sell phones. Like, they don't have other sources of revenue.
The work is bullshit.
The work
is mysterious and important. And we deal with the uncertainty it brings us in the way that Keir would have wanted, together, as a family.
Do we think this show, in the end, has anything new to say about the workplace? And is it really building upon past portrayals of workplaces?
I feel like, yes, it is. Just because the workplace has changed so much in the last, even like 2 or 3 years, the last 5 years, like Slack, Zoom, tyranny of always online, tyranny of always being like a phone beep away from something horrible that you forgot to do at your job. The information that we have learned recently about the ways in which big corporations treat their employees is maybe slightly different. I am thinking about Amazon here and other companies. I don't want to specifically pick on them because I don't want to get sued. But I feel like we've been hearing more stories about companies keeping tabs on their employees in slightly strange ways. Like, you know, the Fitbit yes. participation activity boosting challenges.
No, definitely. The whole thing has the vibe of like every sort of corporate horror story you've heard about just dialed up, which is, you know, right. Like the idea that they know when you go to the bathroom or right.
Yeah.
All that stuff. Like, you know, it's great.
The essential nature of the office comedy hasn't really changed, or the workplace drama. But at the same time, like, everything is just so much higher tech now, and there's so much more information and data than there ever has been before. And in that sense, I think this show is brilliant. And like I said, the idea of bifurcating your brain kind of neatly gets at the idea that you are two selves. You are your work self, and then you are your free self.
Right.
To me, it's just like the most cynical take and the bleakest take and kind of like the end point of a long trajectory from like what? Like the Mary Tyler Moore Show or, you know, those kind of like workplace comedies of the 70s and 80s where people were actually having a nice time at the office kind of and like doing fulfilling, meaningful jobs, but also like finding romance and friendship.
Well, like, that's a good... Mary Tyler Moore is a funny example because obviously what's liberating in that show is that she is a single woman who has a professional job where she's being taken mm-hmm. seriously, and that like is like mildly revolutionary. Like, you know, that is, you know, everyone in the show is basically bowled over that she's not married. I mean, the Mary Tyler Moore Show is the best sitcom ever, just to be clear. But like, and it is funny how, right, like 50 years later, we've arrived at this thing, which is like work is a prison. And your bosses are literal like tyrants and corporate structures are basically just propaganda designed to brainwash you into enjoying something you don't like. And I'm watching Severance and I'm like, this show's pretty on point. Like, this show has a lot to say. And then, to be clear, I enjoy my job at The Atlantic. I'm not even making fun of my own, but like, you know, it's just sort of like, yeah, I feel like that is kind of the mood right now, right?
No, I mean, I definitely, as a person who also very much loves my job and finds creative fulfillment in it, there are still pieces of this that resonate, if not necessarily with me and my experiences of work, with the idea that it has felt more and more, especially during pandemic time, that companies want to own more of you than just your 9-to-5. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, that's the broader experience of what work means, what a career means, what a job means has been slightly tweaked in ways that we're still kind of coming to terms with. And so you're seeing a lot of these pieces about like burnout and professional malaise and everyone just being exhausted all the time, because it feels that for a lot of people, like, work never ends. There's no delineation now anymore between when you're doing work and using that part of your brain and when you're not. And I will now go and watch 3 hours of TV for work. No, just kidding. Well, wine. Really, wine, like, is my delineation. That's why I love wine so much. Because, you know, you have a wine, you're no longer at work.
Yeah. I think we're really in for like a turbulent chapter of history, which is I think is actually turning out to be the case. If we no longer believe that like work provides any sort of meaning in people's lives and is so just a reason to get a paycheck that it's worth completely forgetting about it. And, you know, the premise of the show is that people... Yeah, like they feel so alienated from work that they don't even want to remember that they were there. And yeah, if that's where we're at with our work culture, you know, no wonder we're in the Great Resignation.
Well, I don't think that Severance is saying that. I mean, Severance is a show that is made by people as their jobs. So
that's a good
I think
point.
It's more like an attempt at a corrective act. The narrative that we've had for the last few decades, which is that work is everything. It's your identity. It's your friend circle. It's your like meaning as a human being. I think we're seeing more and more now, and like we at The Atlantic have run some interesting like columns and opinion pieces about this, which is actually you can very much live a meaningful life as a human being that is not defined around your job. You can have friends that are, you know, and activities and other things that you forge your identity around that are not, you know, that allows your work to simply be work, if that makes sense. I think I don't see Severance as pushing that message that we should all like quit and go and, I don't know, start farms, subsistence farms upstate or whatever. But I do think it's an interesting reminder to sort of think maybe slightly more in a slightly more aware sense of what other narratives are saying or what we ourselves have come to accept.
Yeah, our colleague Derek Thompson had that kind of pushback to this narrative that there's a great resignation and pointing out that, you know, like for maybe 3/4 of the country, people do say they're satisfied with their jobs and do find it to be a source of meaning. And, you know, maybe that means that people are just buying into the Lumen propaganda that is being spread in their own workplaces. But it is like a healthy thing for society to strive towards to like make the workplace better and not just make it something that we treat as just something to escape and that we think it's so uncool to even like your job at all. But I don't think Severance is quite saying that. But
no, but I do like the way that Severance kind of tweaks at the things that we have come to accept as part of work life that are supposed to be like motivators, right? Like, you guys know I hate Happy Birthday more than anything else. The song I hate so
you
much
do?
When our colleagues would leave. Do you remember when we would have those morning meetings and we would all have to sing Happy Birthday to whoever's birthday it was? And for some reason, it would take like 3 hours to get through a single like verse of it. And I just absolutely loathed it. But things like that, you know, like the thing.
I severed this memory.
But there are all these like supposedly joyful, innocent things that companies do to keep you motivated at work. And I feel like Severance is not, it's not denigrating them necessarily, but it's saying, think about what these are actually for. And maybe just have that be a more like that bake-off that you participated in is really just a way for us not to have to buy you snacks. Anyway, that's my cynical take. That's why I like it, because I don't think it's necessarily saying things overtly so much as it's putting suggestions up in the ether that you can kind of interpret in different ways depending on your own reality.
I think that is right. I think you have earned a waffle party.
Can I have a waffle party? I don't want a waffle party. I want a melon party and a deviled egg party with defiant jazz, and I want Tramell Tillman to dance because that man can move.
I think that's a good place to wrap our conversation. So let's end on a recommendation. David and Sophie, what is another work of dystopian sci-fi that you think people should check out?
Yeah, I think a lot about Children of Men, the film adaptation of the P.D. James book. I think so much of it reminds me of like the sense that we are coasting towards climate change apocalypse and there's nothing to be done about it. Like there's this general sense of like nihilist despair and bleakness. Obviously, the movie is about a world where reproduction has ceased to function. So I think there's like no childbirth anymore and mankind kind of breaks down as a result and can't handle the idea that this is like the last generation. It's very dark, but it has seemed prescient, like I said, in certain ways about the mood that we all seem to be feeling now. The other thing I would say is there have been a lot of works of sort of reproductive dystopian. I don't know if that's even a way to describe it. Like there, since the Trump election, there have been a lot of really good, smart, thought-provoking books that have come out imagining different kind of reproductive dystopias, kind of some influenced by The Handmaid's Tale. Like there's one by Leni Zimis called Red Clocks that's about an America in which abortion overnight just becomes illegal, which, you know, felt very very kind of earth-shattering when I read it back in 2017 or whenever it came out, 2018. But now it just feels like I need to go and revisit it to kind of understand the bleak hellscape of now. Anyway, now that I've lowered the mood, what do you like, David?
I was just trying to think of something from this year, like, or last, you know, a recent bit of dystopia that was striking me. I mean, After Yang is not quite a dystopia. That's a sci-fi movie that came out this year. It's more got that kind of Severance feel of like, it's a fairly smooth and nice looking and chill world that seems almost designed to calm everyone down. But then there's all this weird stuff under the surface. There's sort of like allusions to a war that we fought with China. There's robots who exist mostly to, like, you know, serve as siblings and friends and stuff. Like, you know, like, there's this just this weird sense of, like, an empty world that I appreciate that kind of a dystopian movie. On, you know, I like the more extreme ones as well, but, like, the dystopian movie where it's just, like, you know, you fill in the gaps of what you, like, what you think has gone wrong.
That's really interesting, because After Yang was a short story taken from a book I reviewed a while ago by Alexander Weinstein called Children of the New World. And they were all, like, these really sharp, really terrifying, slightly tech-inspired, kind of like a more intellectual or more, like, emotionally resonant Black Mirror. But I remember being so kind of gobsmacked by that collection when it came out. So I haven't seen After Yang yet, but I want to very much.
I'm going to plug the book Severance, which has nothing to do with the TV show Severance. They're completely different stories and properties. But 2018 novel by Ling Ma about a gosh darn pandemic that,
what's that?
You know, sort of imperils the human race. But some of the people who get the virus sort of become zombies and they just stick around at work. So similar, some sort of like overlapping themes. And to me, a little bit of a more fun and satisfying work so far than the TV show, which has, again, nothing to do with the book.
Yeah, I've seen people say they're mad at Severance, the TV show, because it's not an adaptation of Severance, the book, which, you know, I understand, no. But...
Yeah, I'm mad at it. Where are the lawyers when you need them? Well, I think that does it for our show. The Review is produced by Kevin Townsend with help from AC Valdez. The executive producer of Atlantic Podcasts is Claudine Abaid, and our art is by Charlie Le Mignon. I'm Spencer Kornhaber. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Okay, Sophie, please give me a normal thank you.
Thank you, Spencer.
Thank you all.